Universität Hamburg.
1661. The English gentleman John Mompesson of Tedworth and an idle drummer got into a serious dispute. Irritated by the sound of drumming and wanting to find any reason to stop it, Mr. Mompesson discovered that the energized musician was busking on a counterfeit permit. Mompesson confiscated the drum kit and stored it securely in a dark corner in the back of his own house. The drummer was sentenced to prison, the story was laid to rest. Months later, Mompesson heard a great knocking at his doors, and I quote, thumping and drumming on the top of his house, which continued a good space, and then by degrees went off into the air. The sound of drumming became a constant nocturnal companion for months, but this time there was no permit to disclaim, no drummer to be imprisoned. The unaccounted sound eventually spread throughout the house until other mysterious occurrences joined the already established disorder. I quote, another night, strangers being present, it purred in the children's bed like a cat, at which time also the clothes and children were lifted up from the bed, and six men could not keep them down. Hereupon they removed the children, intending to have ripped the bed, but they were no sooner laid in another, but the second bed was more troubled than the first. So, unquote. So you see here we're dealing with something that's called it. And it proves to be persistent. Further disturbances from now on worry the Mompesson family, and some of them are hurling in the air over the house, scratching under the children's bed, levitating of furniture, offensive sulfurous smell, frequent silly tricks, unaccounted lights, doors opening and shutting without a visible agent, the sounds of steps without the visible presence of a body, a rustling sound that recalls silk garments, panting like a dog out of breath, the rattling of chains. And you see how familiar we are with these images, and this is 1661. So all along, strangers are continually invited to witness and report about this mysterious occurrence, this is all, somebody's always writing it down. So the story grows particularly in the way the narrator is addressing it. Eventually, the narrator concludes that the unacquainted occupant must be a spirit. And he says, an immaterial presence of undefined character. So it's supposed to be something that affects the body of others without having one of its own. A spirit in this text seems to be an invisible entity that can see and influence a living person. But being invisible, and perhaps even immaterial itself, it is difficult to battle. Gradually, the angry presence starts taking hold of Mompesson's body. I quote, and now and then he, and this is Mompesson, should find himself forcibly held, as it were bound, hand and foot, but he found that whenever he could make use of his sword and struck with it, the spirit quitted its hold. A sword. So now he's using a sword to battle the spirit. Of course, a sword can only be used if there is a body. So even without the body, you already imagine a body just by having this image of the sword. And now the narrator changes it from spirit to specter. It is called specter now, and its presence is unaccounted for by the way it affects the inhabitants. I quote, the man presently reached after his sword, which he found held from him, and it was with difficulty and much tugging that he got it into his power, which as soon as he had done, the specter left him, and it was always observed that it still avoided a sword. Unquote. Other than the earlier spirit, the specter seems to have a body of its own, even if it is conceivable solely in the way it affects another. Marking the unknown with a name and a borrowed physicality helps the narrator literally fight it. The materiality of the specter is inscribed in the sphere of the sword. A sphere seems to be associated with a body that can be hurt. And now other people enter the scene. A gentleman of the company, that's how the character is described, logically concludes that if in presence of another, one should talk to it. And entering into a conversation with the mysterious visitor might lead to an agreement, possibly a positive outcome for both sides. The gentleman who's introduced as yet another stranger performs a public address of the unknown, during which the specter becomes the devil himself. I quote, "Satan, if thee drummer set thee to work, give three knocks and no more." The drumming that first was termed simply it that became a spirit that turned into a specter, now is Satan. Three knocks are heard, the Bible is discovered in the ashes, laying open at the third chapter of St. Mark, which happens to contain the passage on Jesus transferring power to his disciples to cast out unclean spirits from impure, polluted, contaminated houses. Having created a body step by step, Montpesson and his numerous visitors learned how to dispose of it. The final act of conversation serves as exorcism. In the form of a denouement, the drummer himself is consulted and freed from prison, and the evil disturbance, as in a casual move, is put to rest. So here you see how, in this story, I wanted to tell you the story in detail, because it's very visible how a ghost is being created. Step by step. And also the, I know it's easily said, when people talk about ghosts, usually they say they're between life and death, and they're between material and immaterial, and etc., but it's very difficult to understand what this means. So I was hoping that by taking you step by step through the story, it might make more sense. If it can, I don't know. So this is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, poltergeist narrative that we're still retelling each other. The story was first featured in Joseph Glanvill's A Blow at Modern Sadism and Some Philosophical Considerations About Witchcraft, which was published in 1668, and it remained equally prominent in his influential publication Sadismus Triumphatus, or Full and Plain Evidence Concerning Witches and Apparitions. Published in 1681, and this was brought out after Glanvill's death by his mentor, the Cambridge Platonist Henry Moore. It was Moore, a famous philosopher at that time, who had encouraged Glanvill in his investigation of the case in the first place. The publication was soon to become one of the most talked about studies of demonology and witchcraft, and The Demon of Tedworth, one of the most frequently repeated ghost stories of all times. Both Glanvill and Moore followed a rather explicit intention when including the famous Tedworth occurrence in their publications. In the course of the abolishment of purgatory by the Reformation, ghosts were simply banned. Marking death as the hour of entrance to heaven or hell left no space for the undead or the in-between. Yet, as a fast spread of atheism and skepticism followed the Reformation, Protestant and non-Protestant clergy rediscovered the use of spectral matters. The late 17th century chronicles a renaissance of stories that promote supernatural power, many of which resort back to apparitional entities. This form of narrative became to be known, especially in the United States, as providential tale, and it came to represent a medium that God uses to speak to his subjects. In this way, God's language became a collection of supernatural acts or natural ones, sometimes that were interpreted as paranormal, such as was usually the case with floods and lightning. Mm-hmm. So, this was quick. So maybe I will just skip to the end. It was important to mention that this was published within a philosophical treatise and with a certain intention. In the introduction, you could read that the stories were invented and that this never really happened, that Montpesson wanted to sell a collection of stories, and that's how they came up with the story, but it didn't matter. This wasn't an issue, and this is why it was discussed in a certain way in this philosophical treatise. This instrumentalization of ghosts already demonstrates the importance of a serious study of spectral matters. The strong position of ghosts within Euro-American culture is recognizable even today. The story about Mompesson's house itself is still prominent in Euro-American culture. Its development from a banal juridical quarrel to a mysterious private moment framed by a house and confined to bedroom, nocturnal whispers, and innocence of children to a public communal negotiation of the unknown, the invention of a language to converse with it, and the final resolution in a scene of Christian exorcism is prototypical. The narrative suggests that certain disturbances are beyond the reach of earthly laws. For these, special committees are formed, names are found, public rituals are performed, until a strategy emerges that will give meaning to the formerly unknown and thus bring it under control. The house, a space of seclusion and privacy on the one hand, and invitation and reception on the other, receives a central role in this conversion narrative. Whereas bodies that suggest innocence, such as those of children or young women, are the preferred medium. This pattern has many iterations. The demon of Tedworth has had its rightful place within contemporary cultures, updated in regular intervals, dressed in more suitable garments, adjusted to its new environments, and molded in a language closer to current fashion since its first print in Glanville's publication. Only recently, a significant comeback as a highly popular and controversial Hollywood film, The Exorcist, from 1973, turned the story into the most profitable horror film ever to be made. The director didn't need to go as far back as Glanville. The script is based on William Peter Blatty's novel from 1971 under the same title. Blatty, in turn, based his narrative on a documented exorcism performed on a 13-year-old child in 1949. And it would be an easy task to continue unwinding this reference spiral, going through various genres, styles, and discourses. Each setting, each period, will have its own Demon of Tedworth. I'll stop here.